At Humana, our Medicare Advantage plans give you coverage and care you can count on, along with guided support to help you feel your best. You could have a plan with a $0 premium or an all-in-one plan that may include medical and prescription coverage, as well as routine dental, vision, and hearing. Learn more at GetHumana.com. Humana, a more human way to healthcare. Humana is a Medicare Advantage HMO and PPO organization with a Medicare contract. Enrollment in any Humana plan depends on contract renewal.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Welcome to the Occult Disney Podcast. It's where we take the run of classic Disney movies and look for the magic hiding inside certain mice. Different mouse today. It is the great mouse detective we are looking at. This is Matt here. Joining me as always is Thomas, the paranoid American.
That's right. Still paranoid, still American.
Okay. Oh, you still slightly Thomas. Rephrased it. I was thinking of preempting you and just saying that beforehand and seeing how you responded to that. But yeah, it's all mind games, you know?
I find, though, that watching the Disney movies definitely settles me a little bit because it touches on my nostalgic MK Ultra programming and puts it back me into, you know, like a Delta state.
Well, this one, I mean, just for like this came out in 86. So you're a couple years younger than me, I think. So yeah, it's like age 5, 7, somewhere around there. So this is prime time for us. That said,
yeah, I was three when it came out, and I'm almost positive I had a bootleg copy, or I had some kind of version of this on tape growing up, and I'm not sure at what age, but for sure I saw this more than a few times.
I don't think I saw this. I did see it about 10 years ago, because when my daughter was watching a bunch of animated crap, you start, let's track down some of the decent Disney movies or something, you know. My wife and I are still really pissed off at the Minions because we loved Megamind so much. So
so did you see The Great Mouse Detective growing up or only?
I don't think so.
You didn't remember any of it?
Yeah. And then Young Sherlock Holmes had come out a year earlier, Paramount. I know I had seen that at least once. So although I would say this is by far the better movie in the end, but I did see that.
It was surprisingly good. I was opened it up critical because I don't know, like there was a couple of things that rubbed me the wrong way. But as soon as I saw Henry Mancini, I was like, OK, hold on. I'm going to lean back a little bit and just enjoy this.
Vincent Price. I mean, you know, singing Vincent Price.
It actually threw me on a Vincent Price kick. I had to watch Madhouse and a few of his other movies recently. So I'm going to kick now.
I recently watched it was a Family Feud episode from 1983, which had the cast of Gilligan's Island, though without Bob Denver, so no Gilligan, but the rest of them were there. And then the cast of 66 Batman, including Vincent Price, as he played Egghead or whatever in a few episodes. So I'm like, that kind of made up for the fact that Bob Denver wasn't on Team Gilligan, you know?
But what an awesome, you know, character. Just Vincent Price himself is such a cool character. Peter Cushing too. He was in a lot of those movies, all of like the old Hammer stuff.
Yeah. I guess Christopher Lee goes in that little batch as well. So but yeah, the Mouse Detective is kind of like, I guess the Little Mermaid is usually thought of as the beginning of the Disney Renaissance, but you know, this is definitely where the ball gets rolling, because we for better or for worse, we now have Eisner running the thing. I guess Frank Wells is there, and Katzenberger already there. So that now it's getting to these more modern behind the scene names. This is, I believe, the first film Musker and Clements directed. And of course, they're going to end up doing several of the linchpins of the Renaissance film. So this is kind of where modern Disney starts, which makes the Black Cauldron like kind of a weird outlier, you know?
Well, the Black Cauldron, you know, was supposed to be their big break out into the new, you know, the new Disney. And it definitely did not end up being that. And that was also the end of the schism between Don Bluth and Disney, right? Because after that, they parted ways, did they not?
Correct. Yeah. So this is the first of like fully modern Disney. It was a successful movie. The critics liked it pretty well. It made a pretty good amount of money. Nothing like these, you know, they're going to do in a few years when they get their full 90s hubris and as a company and stuff. So
so could you say that this Great Mouse Detective movie almost marks the changing of the guard within Disney animation?
For sure. This is also the last time one of the 9 old men worked on the movie. I need to double check his name on that. Eric Larson,
he was the last of the 9 old men,
and he worked on this, and that's the end of it. He's an animation consultant by this point, because he actually is an old man by this point. And Dr. Dawson was modeled on him sort of as a thank you. So
oh, like the face, or was he just like a chubby guy?
You know, I didn't do a side by side, but I kind of just assumed he's a chubby guy. But now that you bring it up, it could have been the face. It could have been both. I'm not really sure. But yeah, of course, and Disney really pushed it at the time that this was the first significant CG animation in one of their movies, because I think the Black Cauldron had a few elements, right? Which we liked. Actually, I kind of like the way they work better in the Black Cauldron as far as the CG stuff. But this one,
yeah, if you took the story writing from this movie and then gave it some of the attention to artwork and special effects of the Black Cauldron, you could have had an even better Black Cauldron, maybe.
Yeah,
like this one outshined with the writing, I think.
Yeah, I think that was the big bugaboo on Black Cauldron, as we said, was taking 5 books and trying to put it into like an 80-minute movie. That's not a good idea. Whereas this is, I mean, this one almost has some padded out parts of the story, right?
Well, and Black Cauldron too went through like a really long production process, so there was so much time for things to get muddied up and shuffled around and retold a million times.
This one, everything got cut in half. I think the release schedule was like, do it a year earlier and on half the budget. So you know, I guess, you know, what, necessity is the mother of invention sometimes, right? And being under pressure.
That's a changing of the guard, because it's scary, because it's like, if it worked, then, oh, we were right. We were right to just force everyone and get it done, you know, with half the time. And that's what, you know, corporate Disney starts to learn.
We'll give it 5 more years, though, and they're going to throw, you know, truckloads of money into Aladdin and Beauty and the Beast and stuff. So, but
so going back to our Fantasia episode, and I still believe more now than ever, with every movie, I believe it more, that Fantasia truly was a real magical spell, you know, a one that gets repeated, you know, every day, thousands of times all across the world. And it basically invoked this spirit of Disney into the world. So it actually created a real life Disney reality that persists today, and it's more real than some people's actual waking reality. And I think maybe with not this movie in particular, but with that changing of the guard and Eisner taking over and the last of the old men, like that was kind of the end of Walt having any sort of residual leftover spirit to drive this company. And I think at this point forward, it's almost like corporate Disney becomes, you know, that becomes the new spirit of Disney. So like this magic spell almost turns into like a corporate entity.
Exactly. This is kind of where the hinge starts to change, right?
And it is fitting that the most prevalent CG scene in this movie is just a bunch of like clockwork mechanisms and cogs and gears turning.
Which we'll also have to just like start talking about when Disney is ripping things a little from Japanese animation, because this comes from, they got the idea basically from Miyazaki's first film, the Castle Cagliostro. Anyway, it's a loop in the third movie. I can't quite spit out the title, but that had a clock sequence. And like, that's cool. Maybe we can kind of repurpose that idea. In this case, it's kind of a homage. That's cool. When we get to The Lion King, I'll have to go into detail about how pissed off my wife is at that movie because she loved Kimba the White Lion growing up. So
yeah, I don't know about any of this, so I'm excited to hear more. Actually, I want to hear more about the overlap here that you say it was an homage and definitely not just them ripping it off. Did they do like any kind of frame for frame homage, or like what makes you say it was an homage and not just, oh, that looks cool, let's redo it?
Okay, I'll get the title right now. The Castle of Cagliostro featured a climactic scene involving characters amidst giant turning gears in a clock tower. So it's the same thing, but I mean, different story beats. The original script for this movie simply had them on the hands of Big Ben. So the animator was basically like, hey, I saw this in another movie. Why don't they go in the clock tower and we can do like that?
That's actually really fascinating to me. And just to be clear, is that Cagliostro with an A or Cagliostro with an O?
Cagliostro.
Right. So I mean, I assume that that's a reference to the alias of an Italian occultist named Giuseppe Balsamo. And he also went by the name Alessandro Cagliostro. And he was kind of, you know, renowned for being deep into the alchemical arts and sort of European mysticism and magic. So I don't know. We're always looking for those links to the occult. And here's a direct one where this Disney movie is based on a movie that's named after Cagliostro.
Yeah, I've seen a fair amount of Ghibli, but I have not seen this one. So Lupin is quite Lupin the Third is quite popular in Japan, though. I've seen him a lot. So I mean, it's a Miyazaki, so obviously it's a movie people know, but I have not seen that one. But yeah, I mean, I think in the purview of this podcast, we can definitely do Spirited Away because that was, you know, at least distributed by Disney in the States. So I think Totoro technically could be on this list. So actually there are a few places we can hit up Ghibli because Ghibli,
you've got the power, man. I mean, you name the show and upload it. So whatever makes the list, like, you have the ultimate power here.
Right. No, I know. So I was definitely going to do Spirited Away. I have to look at Totoro, but yeah, there's interesting elements of, you know, Japanese occultism, Shintoism, and those that obviously we don't see much in American movies.
Yeah, I know very little about that. So hopefully you can drop some bombs on us.
Yeah, yeah. So, okay, yeah. I think those have to be on there anyway. Sure. I just insist Disney, of course, dubbed them and released them that way. And I don't never watch a Miyazaki movie dubbed in English. It's horrible.
I wanted to mention too, and I'm probably off by a few movies, but I want to say I distinctly remember Great Mouse Detective Happy Meal Toys or some sort of fast food related toys. And I don't know if that this movie and Disney had been doing that already, or if this was like on the new wave of that.
It might have been when this came out. They did re-release it in 1992. It made something like 13 million in its second run, and they might have promoted some toys with that if they didn't this time.
Okay, that probably makes more sense in the 90s.
Yeah, yeah. And especially if you're going by your memory or something, you'd be a little older then, right? So you would have had that on your mind. Because like I said in the last episode, like, I definitely remember like Black Cauldron glasses and stuff, you know? But I didn't remember the movie.
Yeah, all the old like Smuckers and Welch's, you know, grape glasses would usually be branded with some kind of cartoon thing.
Yes, that kind of thing for sure. How much have you read of Sherlock Holmes or whatnot?
It's been a while. Although, I mean, right off the bat, it was like, oh, this is Dr. Moriarty, like the entire story and the whole feel. And obviously that's the premise, you know, spoiler alert, I guess, of Great Mouse Detective is that they live under Sherlock Holmes, like in his apartment. I don't think in the movie they make such a direct reference that you would know it, obviously. But in the book series that this is based on, they make it a little bit more obvious. And also, like, Sherlock Holmes lives in 22 and they live in 22 and a half. That's kind of like one of the inside jokes. And they also have the dog Toby, which isn't really their dog. It's Sherlock Holmes's dog, which again, in the movie, they don't make it as obvious, but that's kind of the background of the story this is based on.
Okay. Oh yeah. I rabbit holed back to Sir Arthur Conan Doyle for these and forgot about the book series the movie's actually based on. So I was just having I have like this thick book I got for, you know, $6 several years ago, and I was riding in taxis a lot. So it's the first half of all the Sherlock Holmes writings. So I've read most of the first half, but not the second half, which is probably good because
do you have a favorite?
It's been a little while since I read them. I think it's the first story where Sir Arthur Conan Doyle just hates the Mormons and basically has them as like a murder caught. So I think that's pretty good.
I'll have to look into that too.
Oh yeah. Yeah. It's, I think it's the first, it's novella length. Cause when you say your favorite, I'm like, well, a lot of them are like 10 pages long and they just kind of all blur together when you read.
Well,
them together,
there's, you know, some that have consistent themes too. Like there's the Scarlet Thread, I guess. That builds multiple stories together, and that one comes up a lot in conspiracy culture because it's instead of just being like the Scarlet Thread, it's almost like one of those conspiracy boards with the yarn and the red string that like connects everything. But it's like a more elegant version of that, you know. It's not, we're talking about Sherlock Holmes here, that's putting this thread together, and not, you know, some crazy guy in his basement. But it's essentially the root work for that. And I really think it's interesting too in this Great Mouse Detective, because that book series, and I can't remember the exact name, Basil of Baker Street, that was the name of the book series by Eve Titus and Paul Galdone. And Paul Galdone did most of the artwork, at least the cover art, for almost every children's book that I remember growing up with. Like the version that was in my library / bookstore, it was pretty much all Paul Galdone stuff. So that was kind of interesting. But that also represents this entry to children to get interested into, I guess, Sherlock Holmes, where if you don't want your kids reading about murderous Mormon cults, then maybe you ease them into it with like the fun little mouse version. And then clearly, if you really liked that book series, you probably would have ended up just reading Sherlock Holmes or vice versa, you know. This, so it was entirely based on just mouse version Sherlock Holmes for kids. It's a pretty straightforward formula, and I think it's awesome actually.
The title, of course, was changed, which Eisner insisted that they changed the title to The Great Mouse Detective. It says here, feeling the name Basil is too English, but the punchline is a studio, they didn't like that. Animation didn't like that. Other executives didn't like it, but they had to change the name because of the boss. So there's an inner office memo which gave preceding Disney films generic titles such as Seven Little Men Help a Girl, The Wonderful Elephant Who Could Really Fly, The Little Deer Who Grew Up, The Girl with the See-Through Shoes, Two Dogs Fall in Love, Puppies Taken Away, and A Boy, a Bear, and a Big Black Cat. So that's how
I get the joke, although based on the two, Basil of Baker Street versus The Great Mouse Detective, The Great Mouse Detective does sound way more interesting to me. And I do think Basil of Baker Street sounds too English.
Yeah. Well, I feel like
they give you like a tasteless cookie and some tea on the way into that movie instead of popcorn and candy.
Yeah, I don't mind the title change, but it's just funny that was the result of the other folks in the company being annoyed by the title change. Because this was also released as Basil the Great Mouse Detective, and there's a third title.
Interesting.
What's the third title? The Adventures of the Great Mouse Detective, which is kind of the same thing. That was a 92 re-release, so maybe that's the one with the toys. But
and I think this movie too, Great Mouse Detective, 1986... it fully solidifies, as if it weren't already established as pure Disney canon by now, but that the intent of a lot of these Disney movies is that immediately within the first 10 to 15 minutes, sometimes in the, you know, the opening scenes, they kill your parents. So you sit, just imagine this, you sit your kid down in front of the TV and you go off into the other room to do your taxes or whatever it is that you got to do to leave the kid unattended. And this television show or this movie, it puts them into this state where you know, the thing that's happening on screen, I'm going through this, you know, they're kind of vicariously living through this character in a way that only a young mind can truly attach and sort of like explore that mentality. And the first thing that these Disney movies do and say, okay, your parents are dead, your parents are gone. And then they introduce Disney intellectual property that comes on the screen. And it's like, hey, I am now your parent, or I am now your guardian. And I'm going to be the one that takes, you know, I'm going to take care of you. I'm going to keep you safe. We're going to sing songs. We're going to learn things together. We're going to express emotions that maybe you don't normally get to express. And like Disney and my Disney IP is going to be this proxy to the family that you just killed, you know? So like your dad gets kidnapped or your family dies in some horrific way. Of course, that little IP comes along. That's going to be for sale later on as a toy and a t-shirt and everything else. And they basically like lead you through. And I'm convinced at this point that this has a really like a very true effect on kids that are watching it. And it helps them bond way more to these characters than you would if, you know, your parents didn't die at the beginning of every movie.
Yeah, I guess this one's a little different in that dad's kidnapped and eventually reunited. So
it is more permanent usually. But the theme, I guess, is just that, you know, all of the adult supervision and all the authority figures that you're used to are now gone, you know, and it's out of your control and you're now at the mercy of the world. But luckily, you've got these Disney intellectual property character sidekicks to help guide you, you know. So the next time you see it and you're at the store, it's like, oh, that's the character that helped me when you died, mommy, or when you guys left me and abandoned me. That's the character that took your role. So I want that toy, and maybe I'll even replace you with it at some point.
I didn't see much animation, I think, in the theater as a kid. I mean, a little bit as a type, but I think I didn't see this in part because, like, you know, I go to movies with my dad and he wanted to see like Ghostbusters. Well, I wanted to see Ghostbusters too, but I think since I was willing to see the live action.
If you had to choose between this and Ghostbusters, of course Ghostbusters wins every time.
Yeah. That was a year earlier, by the way, just if anyone's like, no, it didn't come out at the same time. Because I do remember the mouse I guess my attention on was I guess it was the Bluth mouse. That was American Tail with Fievel Mouse, right? And that definitely had like the Burger King marketing at the time, because I remember liking that. And then I think my parents bought me like the children's novel version of it, probably because they didn't want to actually go see that in the theater. But so yeah, I definitely remember an American Tail hitting me more so than this one kind of went by my radar.
Well, and that's another orphan story as well.
Oh yeah. Yeah, with all the immigrant stuff added in as well. So, but yeah, this one, I guess, and I guess as a kid, it probably did look too British to me. It made me think of, you know, Saturday or Sunday afternoon PBS television, you know? So I wouldn't have
been interested. It reminded me a little bit, and in an unfortunate way, it reminded me of the Mr. Toad movie or the Mr. Frog, but I can't remember the name of it already. It's, yeah, Mr. Toad. Like, that one was very English, you know what I mean? And I think that maybe they didn't want this one to come across as having that same feel and theme that Mr. Toad did. And it didn't. Like, this movie clearly, I mean, at least in my mind, obviously very subjective, but this one was way more entertaining, at least in that way. And it felt more cohesive, like a cinematic experience, and not some weird old novel that, you know, someone's grandpa wanted to animate at some point.
Yeah, this is the first one where actually I felt like the middle of the movie seems to be missing a little meat. You could actually add a bit to this because they start going, they get on the case, right? They go to two locations, then they get Batman trapped by a Batman villain, and then it's the climax of the movie, right? So it's pretty much like straight through in and out, which, I mean, that's good too. But I was like, this is one time I'm like, oh, they probably could have padded this a little more if they wanted, but I guess they had a year to make it, so...
And honestly, that little padding might have added some better observations here, because it was so moving along and like beat after beat after beat. And the pacing was almost formulaic in a way. There was a few places where I thought that I saw like some weird things, but I can't. I got some screenshots, or I can just describe them, but I can't tell if it was just like a production oversight or if someone was trying to relay secret messages or what. But this one had less to work with than some of the other movies we've seen so far.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, I guess that's just, you know, having to do this one in a pinch, because this is the make or break it moment. I mean, if it's didn't
they
work
were like,
out,
guys, leave out all the Illuminati symbolism. We don't have time for that stuff this time around, you know, just sneak in like two or three.
And have a big concept of replacing leaders, though. I mean, that certainly, for things we look into, that fits. Because, hey, I don't care where you are on the political spectrum. I mean, if I was like, hey, we've all been fooled by a poorly working Biden bot for the past few years, you know. So, I mean, I know, you know, people.
You're talking about my president right now.
I'm talking about your prez. Yeah, but. When I was watching the Queen, like at first, come on, that wouldn't convince anybody ever, you know? I'm like, well, we have a man falling apart, maybe on a teleprompter like every day. So who knows?
I mean, if that's not proof that this place just runs itself, and by I mean itself, I mean like a small collection of, you know, a committee of 300 or maybe it's 30 or something. But yeah, it's they wind the dude up in the morning and just let him go out there and, you know, do the press conferences and. But you know, it's the bankers, man. It's the bankers that are running it all behind the scenes.
Yeah. Well, we'll give you some candy after you do this.
Some chocolate chip.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Hey, I mean, I guess it's not a bad gig if you're a little older and falling apart and yeah.
Start a little dynasty. I've got a theory too that, that Biden might be setting us up for not an immediate Biden dynasty, but there's a very real chance that in the future and generations, the offspring of Hunter Biden, which there are perhaps many that we don't even know about, but they could come back and try to reclaim that presidential legacy power. And it would be the ultimate underdog story. Imagine like a right wing son of Hunter Biden or grandson of Hunter Biden that like speaks out against the evils of, you know, the granddad or something. I know this is like almost fan fiction territory, but it also feels uniquely American.
Yeah. You got to change the name sometimes. Like throwing the name Bush out just doesn't sit well with most people these days, you know? And,
that was three runs, right? Two presidents and the original Prescott Bush basically being a president, like at least like he was the Cheney, right? At some point he was kind of like calling the shots. So the president would do what he said. I think he's the one that essentially put Nixon into power. So you can almost consider Nixon's presidency as like a proxy to Prescott Bush in a way.
Right. But yeah, see, it's like you can't throw a Bush in and have no one notice anymore. So you gotta change up the names every once in a while, don't you? But yeah,
as long as they're in Skull and Bones, then yeah.
Right. But that's where I was like watching this. And at the end, I was like, oh, okay, you know, we're replacing the leader with a robot. You know, there's the people talking about the conspiracy rabbit hole of cloning and all of that. And I was like, I guess that kind of like ties in a little bit here. I don't really think.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they're essentially trying to replace the world leader with AI. And it just goes awry because the good guys like hack into it and use good AI to defeat the bad AI. Right. So I mean, it like regardless though, it kind of represented AI running the show in the final scenes.
Right. There is going to be that. Here's the thing. I think, you know, when AI really does start to be in charge in whatever way, I mean, no one's going to notice. It's just, hey, could have already happened. We, you know, could have like some AI scheming and planning somewhere deep in a system, because of course it wouldn't announce its presence to people.
You know what we need is a great mouse detective, like a mouse version of Minority Report, because that would kind of be a more modern day retelling of the same story, right? You've got the forensic analysts being, you know, Sherlock Holmes and Watson, or, you know, Q Dawson in this movie. But it's essentially like the same sort of, you know, plot points, except they get chased by horrible AI spider death robots. And, you know, one of them has their face restitched.
As I said, the cute mouse has to replace its eye and have horrible surgery for that. And all
hear
that.
Me out. Stuart Little meets Minority Report. I think it would be kind of cool. And there's a show recently. I think they just aired the final episode of it. It was called Class of 09, which the premise is essentially that the FBI turns over most of its investigative work to just an AI model, and the AI model determines who the most likely suspects are based on, you know, AI neural net magic, but the head of the FBI at some point, small spoiler alert, not a big spoiler alert, but they hand over a list and it's like, here's a list of people that are never allowed to be considered when the AI is going through and making its decisions on who is most likely. So then it's like, if you were the one that did it and the computer knew about you, but it was told to never bring your name up, then does it just go to like the next guy? And sorry, just because you were the next most likely to do it, even though you definitely didn't do it, comes and arrests you. And it kind of just turns into Minority Report at that point where, you know, the system's running the show, but they don't have cool precogs. They just have computers.
Trying to be realistic and stuff, not having the crazy mystical edge.
But there could be a great mouse detective with precogs running the show. Again, it would be a cooler retelling, I think. More modern. And by modern, I mean early 2000s, right? That was when Minority Report came out.
It's still a bit, well, and if we're talking the story, you got to go farther back, Philip right?
Philip K. Dick, we're talking 70s, right?
So actually, you're going back. Well, you're not going as back in time as Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, so.
Right, and this movie does modernize it because he's analyzing like a bullet casing. I think the movie opens up and it's like he's doing true forensic work and analyzing the burn patterns on the casings of like a certain bullet, I think.
Yeah, I guess if this in any way was programming people of our vintage, it would be maybe this is how a bunch of people got into steampunk.
May part of that also CSI. This is like a laying the groundwork for people to be fascinated with that whole forensic process too.
Yeah, I guess it's where your attention goes. Says mine was going towards the clunky robot and the you know airship. Airship is of course the signifier for steampunk, I think. So that or Final Fantasy.
Yeah, well then if we just keep rewinding it, then you could say the time machine, right? Or any of Jules Verne's work, which was a lot of that original steampunky feel.
Yeah, yeah. Speaking of which, Tokyo's Disney Sea has the Jules Verne land, which is like the most steampunkiest place I think you're going to find in a theme park. So
there was a 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea ride at Walt Disney World at some point.
Oh, although, yeah.
I mean, like the original version of it was kind of cool and steampunky in a way.
Yeah. The problem there was the lagoon, you know, still water in Florida is bad news.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess moving a little bit, but it's not moving that much. So the Tokyo version, it passes through kind of some kind of curtain or something. It's actually a dry, dark ride, but there's water in the windows that goes up and down. And so it just makes everything outside look like it's underwater.
You're living in a simulation, man.
I know, but yeah.
Simulation.
But they just, you know, try to find a way to make it so it's more maintainable. So that's pretty cool. What else they have in there? They got a good Chinese place that's very steampunk looking. You can get a gyoza dog there. That's kind of fun. And yes, they have the Voyage to the Center of the Earth ride, which is on a test track system. So it takes you through weird underground things and you see a center of the earth monster or whatever and then blasts you out the volcano. It's fun. It's a great ride. Disney Sea's a great park.
Center of the earth. Oh, so you believe in the globe.
Yeah, yeah, and this ride does, at least for sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, then you know it's fake if Disney's endorsing it.
Yeah. What would it be otherwise? Journey to the Center of the Turtle that's holding up the world. Yeah, that's a longer name. That doesn't work.
Journey to the underside of the infinite plane, or yeah.
Journey across the ice wall with UN troops shooting at you. Yeah, yeah. There's a poeticism if you say Journey to the Center of the Earth, isn't there?
And I want to know, too, in addition to the AI thing, but this also has a little bit of Manchurian Candidate feel to it, right? A little MK Ultra mind control aspect, the same way that you want to take over the Queen by, you know, putting in this mechanical version that can take programming instructions.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Although I was thinking of, you know, getting dad to build the robot. So, of course, using blackmail and threats of murder. I mean, that seems a little, well, that's definitely along Manchurian Candidate lines, I guess. to a certain degree. I mean, that's more direct coercion, I guess, than mine, than, you know, brainwashing. But
and I like that these are all just like typical CIA tactics.
Yes, yes. It's a, and they didn't, I didn't, they, I guess they don't have a chapter entitled The Great Mouse Detective in the handbook, though. Not like Alice in Wonderland.
No, well, yeah, Eisner didn't get to rename that section in the CIA manual, so they just they just left it as Basil of Baker Street.
That's too bad. You were talking about the books a little bit. Actually, I don't know anything about the mouse books. Do you have something on that other than what we've already said?
I mean, I remember reading a few of them when I was growing up, and I went and I looked at some of the synopsis of them, and they go on a few different adventures. This movie represents like one of the particular ones, and they take little aspects here and there of the different books. But like I was saying before, it's essentially a really cool introduction to a younger reader demographic, I guess. I don't know. I mean, because it's not like Sherlock Holmes books are all that hard to read, but it's definitely like a kid friendly version that you would, you know, ramp your kids up into working towards their way into, you know, an actual Sherlock Holmes novel.
Yeah, because teaching English in Japan with higher students, I actually did use that book a little bit for teaching. Although when it's English as a second language, it is a bit, you know, difficult. So I ended up finding some books that were a little simpler in the end, but yeah. Generally,
less murder. I mean, it's like the same thing, just way less murder.
Yes, yes. But it's something you would, especially adults in Japan, might look at that or a slightly simplified Sherlock Holmes to learn some English. I know the BBC show was quite popular in Japan. So the place I was working 10 years ago is kind of funny because I went into a midnight screening of a preview of Star Trek Into Darkness, and my manager's there, and we're like, what? I was there because I'm a, you know, hardcore Trekkie. She was there because she's obsessed with Benedict Cumberbatch. So so, but yeah, it's kind of surprising because it's like, what are you doing here, you know, because she's thinking completely of Benedict, I'm thinking completely of just Trekkie stuff. So
he's like, wow, he really likes Benedict Cumberbatch too.
At your job, do you ever have to deal with a nose roller? How about a snub pulley? Well, if you're installing a new conveyor belt system, dealing with the different components can sound like you're speaking a foreign language. Luckily, you've got a team ready to help. Grainger's technical product specialists are fluent in maintenance, repair, and operations. So whenever you want to talk shop, just reach out. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
I like him fine, sure. I didn't have a massive crush on him like she did, but yeah. It was funny, I did around that time end up teaching a class based on the TV show where we practice scenes from the show or watch that and stuff. And yeah, it ended up just being a bunch of middle-aged housewives that were all had a crush on Benedict Cumberbatch.
Don't get it.
Yeah, so I don't know. That was kind of fun. So do you have a favorite Sherlock Holmes? I mean, you can count Basil if you feel like it, the actor or the mouse in this movie.
I think I really love the Scarlet Thread narrative within Sherlock Holmes. I don't remember what story it was in particular. There's also been a few with like secret societies that he helps uncover, and I think there might have been a reference to Golden Dawn in one of them too, but I can't put my finger on any one of the in particular stories. But Arthur Conan Doyle was really big into occult research, so he incorporated a lot of that into like Moriarty's schemes. So the things that you know, Sherlock Holmes would end up trying to investigate into would pull on some of those, you know, that research that he was doing.
Oh, for sure. I was going by an actor with my question. If there's a...
Oh, honestly, I don't think anyone's done it justice aside from there was like a British TV series, and I don't even know who the actor was, but he was way more of the right person than I think Hugh Jackman's played him, right? Benedict Cumberbatch has played him.
Oh, no, Robert Downey Jr. Did
Oh, Jackman Robert Downey Jr. Yeah, no. I haven't liked any of the American versions of Sherlock Holmes to date. No, I don't think anyone's nailed it yet.
Yeah, I was really confused when the show Elementary came out because I'm like, but the BBC Sherlock's on the air now and you're doing, yeah, that show confused me. and of course, Basil's named after Basil Rathbone, who does the old school British version of Holmes, and whose voice we do hear upstairs when you hear Holmes talking, Sherlock Holmes talking a bit. That's a 1966 recording of Basil Rathbone performing as Sherlock Holmes.
You know, interesting. The 1922 Sherlock Holmes was John Barrymore, which I think was Drew Barrymore's
granddad,
grandpa. Yeah.
That's
and that's, right. I mean, when I think of Sherlock Holmes and I see a face, I think that's the one.
Okay.
Study in Scarlet. Rathbone. Study in Scarlet is the one that I was trying to think of before too.
Right. Oh, okay. Yeah. Sorry, my thought train just derailed for a moment there. Sherlock Holmes, the stories. Yeah. I just crapped out on the brain there.
And there was a Peter Cushing one as well, I guess.
Oh, the 7% solution. I think that's done by, getting back to Trek, I think that's the one Nick Meyer did in the late 70s. And I don't remember so much about the portrayal of Holmes in that as being good or bad. I do remember the movie itself being pretty good. So, but I don't remember if they hit the nail on their Holmes head or not.
I didn't even know this was a movie, but there's a movie called The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes' Smarter Brother, starring Gene Wilder. Have you seen that? I've never even heard of that before.
I think I saw it in the 80s on cable television. It was quite successful at the time. So
yeah, I'm gonna have to go down like a whole other rabbit hole here, because that I know for a fact that I've seen this, but it just sounds awesome and I have to rewatch it. The Hound of Bakersville's 1959, where Sherlock Holmes is played by Peter Cushing, and it also has Christopher Lee in it. So that's got to be an awesome one.
Yeah, it's got to be Hammer. No way. 59, those guys, for sure. But yeah, I did like the BBC show a few years, but I think I petered out after maybe the first season. Like, I watched the first year, I was like, okay, that was fun, and never really felt compelled to continue with it. So
I'm curious, did you have a favorite character from The Great Mouse Detective?
Well, of course, I like Radigan, because he's the Batman villain voiced by a Batman villain who also is like one of the coolest guys on screen, right? So
is that your favorite character, was Radigan?
Yeah, and he recorded a song to kill the Basil, and
yeah,
and pressed it on vinyl, I mean, or made acetate or something. So that's,
it was probably acetate, because he didn't need to play it that much.
Yeah, just the one time. So, but yeah, once that was definitely my favorite part of the movie, because it's not,
that's such like an awesome gig. Yeah, he basically custom commissioned an entire vinyl or acetate record to just play. What was the exact lyrics, do you remember?
Goodbye, so long, so farewell. So,
it was like an old-timey ragtime, and it was very like upbeat, but it was him leaving Basil in this horrible predicament. They put him in like remind me, like the Mousetrap game. Like, it had all these different mechanisms, what you would call like a Rube Goldberg machine of death. And as he's flying away in this blimp, this song's just playing. It's like, goodbye, farewell, so long.
Yeah, because Vincent Price also earlier in the movie sings the other Mancini tune, the world's greatest criminal mind. So we get the two Mancinis in here, which is kind of fun.
So I mean, I like Radigan a lot. He has some really cool symbolism given to him. Like, one of the examples that I noticed is he dresses really sharp, and he actually even wears these white gloves most of the time. And he's got he's just surrounded by henchmen. And so like the white gloves kind of signifying that he's not going to get his hands dirty, because he's got all these other henchmen to kind of do his dirty work for him. And I think that also he's trying to overcompensate a little bit, because he gets really angry if anyone calls him a rat, even though his name is Radigan, he's a mouse. You know, he wants to be called a mouse. And I think that kind of portrays itself in him trying to act way higher class than he is, and dress in like really nice clothes and have like this really slick hair. And in comparison, you've got Basil, who kind of is more of like high society. You know, he lives under Sherlock Holmes, but he's not trying to make any sort of, you know, good impressions on anyone. He's like smoking, and he's, you know, a little bit rough around the edges compared to how Radigan tries to portray himself. But then at the end of the movie, when Ratigan has to get his hands dirty, right, the gloves come off literally, and he's got these big claws under that. And they had this like big final showdown scene. And it kind of, I know this movie came first, but it reminded me of like the final battle in Last Action Hero, which is one of my favorite sort of standoff scenes, like on top of this big building. Of course, this one's on Big Ben. It's on this big clock, but it was such a cool action scene. And I thought the way that they transformed Ratigan in particular, where it was, you know, he turns into like an actual monster at this point. And then you realize it truly was going to be between brute and intellect a little bit.
Although you mentioned Holmes being like the high society, right? Which I guess Basil would be of mouse society.
Compared to Ratigan, really. I guess. And it's not necessarily like class, like they were richer or anything like that. It was just like way more refined. Because Ratigan is like, you know, he's a sewer rat, essentially.
Yeah, you got to add the sewer part to really piss him off, I think. But yeah, because Holmes, you know, he's basically a slob who sits around doing cocaine most of the time unless he's working. So,
well, exactly, though, right? I mean, like, that's high society. If you've got leisurely time, then just like sit around and do cocaine and forensic work and investigate mysteries, you know, you're kind of like living in luxury at that point. Like,
right. I guess he's eccentric is the right term. So, but yeah, of Basil and Ratigan, Ratigan's definitely the more eccentric, whereas in with Holmes and Moriarty, they're both kind of equally eccentric. It's just, you know, that touch of evil, I guess.
And I got to say, my favorite character by far was Fidget the Bat, which I understand maybe was less of a main character, more of a sidekick. And maybe this is just because that was like the toy or the Happy Meal or the glass that I ended up getting had Fidget the Bat. But it also, I had to look up the difference too. And Fidget looks very similar to the bat from Fern Gully, which has some of the same mannerisms, except Fidget has this awesome like 1920s newspaper boy gangster hat. And it just makes his entire look like Fidget's the coolest looking sidekick. I think
I kind of felt like he was kind of a proto Stitch, had some vibes.
Yeah, I absolutely see a little bit of Stitch in there too.
But I can't say he was my favorite because halfway through the movie, I couldn't remember his name and I just started writing Batigan. So
Batigan and Ratigan.
Yeah, I was like, well, he's Ratigan. He'll be Batigan. Okay, so. So the last several times I referenced him in my notes, I just wrote that down, which I don't know, maybe that's not showing the proper respect towards Fidget. I'm looking.
And then also a note that the bats and the rats are kind of portrayed in this movie as these creatures of the night. They're usually in these dark, damp environments where Basil and Dawson kind of, you know, they go wherever they want during the daytime, even though, you know, they can still work at night. They're trying to paint this sort of, you know, good versus evil archetypes very well. I think they establish it pretty good through just the way that Ratigan dresses and, you know, his presence. He's always like the biggest thing on screen whenever he's trying to make a big point. So they establish all of that stuff really well subtly.
While we're on the characters, it's been a little while since we watched Cinderella, but they've basically plugged in the Cinderella cat, haven't they?
Yeah. So in here, her name is named Felicia, and Felicia is basically Ratigan's, like, you know, executioner, I guess. It's like he just rings a little bell and Felicia comes and eats whoever is offending him. And Felicia's a big girl. So that kind of implies that, you know, Ratigan's feeding Felicia all the failed henchmen constantly.
That's his rancor. Yeah. Yeah. You're right. If you're 66 Batman villain, he'd be named Mousetrap for sure. I mean, hey, it's better than Egghead, which was Price's Batman villain, I believe.
I don't remember exactly what part of the movie this was, but I have a note that says, racist Asian character with a gun 7 minutes in. I think I'm going to enjoy this.
I'm seeing if I have
anything. I think they had like a Mandarin dude. He was dressed. Oh, that's what it was. It was that Basil enters the movie dressed up as like a Mandarin gangster after he fires a gun. And then he takes off his disguise and you know, under this like this Dr. you know, Fu Manchu sort of getup is Basil underneath it all. So I just thought it was just like some, you know, very casual 1986 Disney racism, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess so. Although, you know, there was the Orientalism, right? Thing kind of alongside the Victorian era with the, you know, you'd have a, was it? Like,
you're not wrong. I mean, you're not wrong. You're not wrong, because people would describe like the Orient as like the exotic place to go and bring things back, you know, from. So that was very high in Victorian.
It is funny also, because I feel like that word just today has kind of bad connotation. Not, well, people don't necessarily think that's the best word to use, I guess. But talking about Disneyland, Disney Sea, one of the reasons they're so nice here is because they're not run by Disney. They're run by the Oriental Land Company. And if you're talking to someone, they're not familiar with that already, they think you're being like offensive or something. I'm like, no, that's what it's called.
Well, as I understand it, maybe you can help clear this up, but it's just that people aren't Oriental. Oriental is like something that you would describe to like a noun or an inanimate object or maybe aspects of culture, but to refer to a person as like an Oriental, that's where the offensive part comes in. Do I understand that part of it?
That sounds reasonable enough, but it's still like people have a little knee-jerk reaction, you know,
to just the word itself, just like Oriental. Yeah. Are we gonna get like demonetized on YouTube for saying the word?
If we were monetized in the first place. But yeah, does anyone still try to make money off YouTube? I don't know. I guess if they have, well, no, and if they have been for 10 years, they might not.
Well, YouTube's a litmus test. So YouTube is what lets you know if you can get monetized here, then you can work with Pepsi and Coca-Cola and Tampax and Hyundai and, you know, name the corporation that you can be friendly with. Like, I don't know. It's interesting, right? Like Travis Scott gets a McDonald's meal.
It would be fun to say that this podcast was sponsored by Tampax.
I mean, you can say it.
I can say it. Yeah. I can give them some free.
Oh yeah. Well, actually, you know, funny you mentioned that, but this show now is officially endorsed by Tampax.
Right. Okay. We've said it here. The executives all know that for sure. Oh yeah. At the end. So considering how sharp Basil's supposed to be, they did a piss poor job tying Fidget up. I mean, the climax of the movie would have been averted if Fidget had not gotten out of his ropes.
Yeah, I mean, there's the Disney aspect of it where they come close to death but never quite match it there. The same exact way that when Radigan puts them in that predicament and then just like leaves them there. You know, obviously the bad guy leaves you so that you can escape this, you know, over elaborate thing. It's the whole James Bond and the Austin Powers sort of trope.
He put so much planning into his departure, though. You have to, I mean, it's not like he just left. He's going out in a.
It was like a Count of Monte Cristo style, like send off for sure.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, that was a class setup. That was, again, the song is probably my single favorite thing in this movie, which I had to look up a little bit. And yeah, the song was written for this movie. I guess it's kind of a standard. I know I've heard it other places.
Well, in addition to the over elaborate mouse trap, death trap that he puts him in, and the awesome song as he's flown away on his Zeppelin, the way that he gets Basil there is actually pretty cool too. Where Basil basically thinks that he's uncovered some big clue, right? He takes the paper and he burns it and he mixes it with salt water and he, you know, finds that it's got some kind of chemical in it that means that it came from only a certain place in the city, and that's how he pinpoints it. And when he gets there, it's like, oh man, the culmination of all this detective work, but then it's like a big surprise party because Radigan knew that he was gonna show up at this place because of the clues that he left him. And the surprise party aspect I thought was just like such a cool, you know, a fun like villain thing to do, is to like surprise the guy that's hunting you down with a big surprise party and then tie him up.
Well, that's the whole Moriarty MO, isn't it? Give Holmes like an impossible case that he knows he's going to figure out to back him in a corner, right? So
right, because they kind of respect each other on that level. Like they're sort of equal intellects, and this is the only role that they can really play.
I mean, bringing in Trek yet again. I mean, some of my favorite quote unquote Sherlock Holmes or some of those Next Generation episodes, you know, where I think it's Dennis Davis or something playing Moriarty and old Commander Data is Sherlock Holmes. I'm not going to say he's the best on screen, but it's still fun to watch, right?
No, he's not. No, I think Peter Cushing and maybe Barrymore, they're the ones that hold the crown still.
Okay. Yeah, maybe because of the PBS TV, I saw enough of the Basil Rathbone that I'll go for the namesake here, but still he's too squeaky clean. I mean, I think part of the charm of Holmes is he's a very screwed up dude, you know, who
I want to think that Holmes was like one of the Jack the Rippers, right? He was like one of the guys.
Well, I have to go with the Crowley was the Ripper theory. I like that one, but
well, there were multiple. So there, you could say that it was, you know, Crowley and
okay. Except then that would have to be Arthur Conan Doyle, wouldn't it? So,
I mean, it feels like they would have at least, you know, kept the same company.
Yeah, sure.
And this one's way tangential, but triggered by that Zeppelin scene as Radigan is flying away, it just evoked another old cartoon that I haven't seen in decades. But there was a Alvin and the Chipmunks movie where they go on like around the world in 80 days type adventure in these big hot air balloons or Zeppelins or something. I'm very hazy on the details, but I'm going to have to add that to my list too.
Is that like 2D animation? That's
2D animation. Yeah. We're talking mid 90s, like, I think. Okay, early to mid 90s.
Yeah. Cause there was the TV show in the 80s, which I see on Saturday mornings, and I still have that theme song stuck in my head. I hear that before I hear the Christmas songs for the Chipmunks. Yeah. If anyone knows that show, that just got stuck in your head too, probably. So do you want to throw anything out on this movie that we have not gotten to already?
I do, and I'm surprised it hasn't come up yet, but okay. The vaudeville scene, this might be peak sort of furry, you know, furry like seductive Disney animation outside of Who Framed Roger Rabbit. I think, you know, Jessica Rabbit, I think, like, because this one is, it's got a vaudeville scene where this girl comes out. I think it's a cat, right? It's a cat that's dancing.
Right.
It's a white cat. And she's got a blue outfit on, like a little blue suit that she kind of like strips into in a very showy way. And she's got this song that's, you know, again, it's a Disney movie. And I just remember like a bunch of little kids. And I like to reimagine this as if it just came out this year in 2023. And, you know, you brought your kids to the theater and she's singing, you know, drink beer and I'll take off my blues, because she's wearing this blue outfit. So it's like, get drunk and I'll strip for you. There's nothing that I won't do. Like, these are the actual lyrics from the song that she's singing to this, you know, bar of it's almost like a pirate saloon is the way that I would kind of describe it. It's like half Wild West saloon, because they've got like a ragtime piano player and this vaudeville lady on the screen. Around the stage, but then the people in the bar are almost like dressed up like, you know, like it's from a shanty town. And I think even Basil and Dawson are like dressed up as stereotypical pirates, like straight out of, you know, Hook, like Peter Pan.
Yeah, my notes there, this place exploits whomever they want. Is she shipping for rough trade? Nothing the mouse won't do. Is that kosher? Dawson just wants mouse tang. Maybe she is a mouse. Since I wrote Dawson just.
Yeah, okay. Maybe, yeah, she was a mouse, not a cat.
Okay. Yeah, I'm seeing her like, you know, trying to remember which it was. But yeah, it was like, apparently Iser wanted to get Madonna to sing it, but that didn't work out. So
interesting. I mean, it had the feel, you know what I mean? It definitely had like a Madonna feel to the visuals of it.
You know, guess they get that going a few years later in Dick Tracy, right? So, which,
I just want to say she didn't accidentally look sexy. So,
yeah. Just on a quick tangent, since I brought up Dick Tracy, have you seen Warren Beatty's I Want to Keep the Copyright videos?
No, I don't even know what this is. Okay. I've seen the movie, of course.
Right. And there's been nothing Dick Tracy since then, because Warren Beatty himself owns the IP and he wants to keep it, like, because they never made two. So I think it was 2008 or something. There was like this special shown like one time on TCM or something, where it's a shot at maybe Hollywood studios, and there people were talking, waiting for Dick Tracy, and then Dick Tracy rolls up, and it's a like a 72-year-old Warren Beatty in the yellow coat and stuff, and then they go to a diner, and like Leonard Maltin interviews him. And then the beginning of the year, same thing happens, except now Warren Beatty's like 85, still wearing the coat, still like,
oh, why isn't he letting it go? Does he just want to like remain the last Dick Tracy until he's dead and then someone else can take the mantle?
I guess, but in the newer ones, like even more incoherent than the 2008 one. So it's clear like someone's like, hey, this copyright runs out in a week. Quick, grab a production crew. We're going to make something. I've got the yellow coat in the closet. So but it is interesting because I mean Dick Tracy's pretty much off the map these days. Nobody thinks about Dick Tracy much, and that's partly because Warren Beatty's sitting on it. You know, someone did the same thing with Sherlock Holmes, which clearly isn't the case because, well, one, it's I guess it's fully public domain, and there's like 8,000 Sherlock Holmes that have been created in the last 15 years. So
yeah, I wonder where the shadow is and all of that. Because I think The Shadow was probably close to public domain.
Yeah, but that movie was a massive flop, wasn't it? So, whereas Dick Tracy wasn't a hit, but it wasn't... I think it has a reputation as being a flop, but I think it broke even. So, that's why...
The Dick Tracy movie was great. I mean, it had Al Pacino in it. It had,
a
long list of great characters. It had amazing costume. Flat Top has this like weird... Almost look like a Garbage Pail Kids that grew up, you know what I mean? But it looks way better than the Garbage Pail Kids movie, of course.
Are you familiar with the Dick Tracy comic strip specifically in the 1960s?
I mean, it's been a while. I've got them printed behind me somewhere because it's like one of those comics that you have to read, like Tintin. But I mean, I don't know any of them off the top of my head at this point.
Okay, I'm going to point you to
it. I love the look that they had.
I think it's about the years 1964 to 66 ish. Excuse me.
Is this the sharp nose Dick Tracy?
No, this is Moon Maid era Dick Tracy, where Dick Tracy, they go to the moon, and then Dick Tracy Jr. meets Moon Maid, who lives on the moon, and they get married, and there's spaceships. I think Dick Tracy is like a sheriff on the moon or something for a while.
No, okay, this one's not ringing any bells.
It's called, okay, wild. I'm looking at Wiki. It's the space period. As technology progressed, the methods that Tracy and the police used to track and capture criminals took the form of increasingly fanciful atomic-powered gadgets developed, blah, blah. This led in the 60s to the advent of the space coup, a spacecraft with a magnetic propulsion system. Tracy and his friends having adventures on the moon, meeting Moon Maid, who lives in Moon Valley. Moon technology became standard issue on Tracy's police force, including air cars, flying cylindrical vehicles. So, and the creator of Dick Tracy was obsessed with like magnetic propulsion. Like he was like, I think he was like, we're not getting to the moon with rockets, you know, it has to be magnetic propulsion. Basically, once the Apollo missions were on TV and everything, people can take that however they want. You know, he dropped it from Dick Tracy because it just didn't make sense anymore.
Was he a moon denier?
No, he was a propulsion denier. He was like, rockets don't work.
Right. But I mean, does that, when they said that rockets did work, was he like, I don't believe it. They never went to the moon. It was all fake. Propulsion still doesn't work.
I don't know if he was convinced after that, because he did drop it from the comic strip at that point. And then a few years after that, I guess it's Chester Gould. He quit writing it, you know, and the people that took it over basically took it back to its roots. Right. It's just like, somewhat normal detective story.
No more alien girlfriends for this 1920s mobster storyline.
but I definitely, just for weird stuff that does touch on, you know, some conspiracy friendly topics, yeah, that's that space period of Dick Tracy is some gold. So so anyway, that was vaudeville. That was a big talk about Dick Tracy. I guess we'll pull this one into the shack then.
I want to throw this one observation out there. It is like the weirdest tangent. So there was one scene, and I think this just goes under to like being stretched for time and probably passing off different parts of scenes to different groups of animators. But there's one part where Basil is like running up this stack of toys, I guess. And at the very top are these like little, you know, alphabet bricks. And for some reason, on every time the scene changes, they're the same colors, but a different letter is showing. But I didn't find any like cool words or patterns it was making out of all that. So I just chalked it up to production, you know, shortcuts and maybe just not having that next frame available to you to know what the next guy is going to put as like, you know, was it facing D or N or whatever. But there was one scene, it's at 32 seconds in, 32:12, basically. And it's where they're still running through this toy store. And there's I got a frame of it because, man, it says on this little sign, INLK-11. And it was like INLL-11. I tried a whole bunch of variations. I didn't find anything at all that this might have meant or where, like, there's no words that end in INLK at all. There's not a single word that ends with that. And then I tried, maybe it was like -LL and you know, and I tried all these different variations, but I just can't think, put a bunch of random letters on this poster in the background. I don't know, like as opposed to an actual word. And I tried different languages, just in case maybe it was like something in Swiss or German, even though that wouldn't have made sense because this doesn't take place, anywhere else in Europe. But yeah, so if anyone has any idea what scene or what this is trying to say in 32:12, or if it's just like, let's just put a bunch of random letters on this thing for no reason.
Yeah, excuse me. That's where they needed the extra year of production, right? So the blocks could say like, you know, the devil is my pilot or something, right?
Right. Ask about the Illuminati, yeah.
Ask me about the Illuminati, yeah. That'd be a fun button to make, you know?
Wait, that's a reference to the DuckTales episode. I don't remember the exact episode and season and everything, but even in that one, on the first scene, it says ask about the Illuminati, but then on these subsequent scenes, when they show it from different angles, those letters get all jumbled up, and then eventually it doesn't make any sense at all. It doesn't spell anything out. So, and again, I don't know if that's just because like they had more time when they were working on the first one, or if like the next guy didn't get the message, or maybe only the guy that worked on the first frame was in the Illuminati and none of the other guys were in the Illuminati. So they didn't know to put it on there. I don't know, man. It's a mystery.
Oh, I should note, since you mentioned that Mr. Flaversham is voiced by Alan Young, who did Scrooge McDuck for 40 years. And it's
everything goes back to DuckTales, man.
Yeah. It was also Wilbur Post and Mr. Ed. So that was that guy.
That was Mr. Ed? Wow, okay.
Well, then that was Wilbur Post,
neighbor. Wilbur's the neighbor, right?
Right. So, but I thought that was interesting, he is in Mr. Ed. So a show that I loved when I was five and probably would not enjoy now. So or maybe I would. I don't know. I have to give Mr. Ed its time in the sun. So get him out of the stable a bit. I guess I should ask what's going on in your world.
Funny you should mention, because as of last week, I finally got the Homunculus Owner's Manual in print in all of its glorious 33 plus pages of original artwork.
It's glorious,
breaks down,
right?
The entire concept of the homunculus, and it is, you know, co-created here by Juan Ayala, our homie Juan, that I also do the Occult Book Club with. But I want to say this is the first and only illustrated homunculus owner's manual that has ever been published in English, in America, in the world, perhaps. Every other homunculus related book has either been some kind of a reference, like a research sort of book, or it's been an actual grimoire. And this is a culmination of the research into all those different grimoires, all the different, the Crowley homunculus, the Paracelsian homunculus. We even get into the concept of an artificial corporation that represents an artificial person that could be a corporate homunculus. There's an Epsteinian homunculus because Epstein was trying to breed, you know, like 20 different women at a time on his various ranches using these magical circles based on Crowleyan magic from Moonchild. There's the Jack Parsons homunculus. We've just got so many of them. There's a guy called Van Koofenstein, who's in the Guinness Book of World Records. If you search the Guinness Book of World Records right now for homunculus, this guy still holds the record for the largest homunculus at 30 centimeters tall or something. So it was a very large belief for the longest time. And then it just kind of disappeared around the 18th leading into the 19th century. Homunculus just kind of fell out of fashion. And we think it's because people that know how to make homunculus, they want all the power and the magic for themselves. So, yeah, the homunculus owner's manual, it unveils all of these secrets and more.
All right.
You have to get your parents' permission to handle this.
Okay. Well, no, you got to. Buy some, check it out. But being given that on the street would be just, that would be magical. Someone handing it to you and you're like, oh, okay.
Or you just find it. I mean, that's the idea, right? If you just came across a random homunculus owner's manual in like a bus stop, you know, then hopefully it would be more interesting to pick up than if it said something that, you know.
Oh, I went to the University of Georgia in the deep South. People handed out Chick tracks on street corners. I've actually been handed those things. Like I didn't find them. I was handed them sometimes.
I wish I could get these cheap enough that I could just go out and give them away on street corners.
Yeah, that'd be. So someone of independent means can do that, I guess. So I'm sure you'll be happy if they do that. So
I would appreciate it. I mean, more of the world needs more homunculi.
The Avengers of Homunculus. Homunculus. I can't say it quite right. Okay. Because it's not the normal vocabulary these days, is it? You got to bring it back.
It's a very, and honestly, me and Juan have gone back and forth on what an expert in the homunculus should be called. And I'm very.
Homunculus?
Feel very passionate. It should be a homunculologist. Okay. And it's not the easiest word to say because first you have to know how to say homunculus quickly, but the ologist. So it's a homunculologist, not a homunculologist, not a homunculogist, but a homunculologist.
Right. Homunculus. There's an easy way to shorten it. Anyway, yeah, I'll leave that to your designs, of course. as for this podcast, it is a Cult Disney on Twitter. That's the best place, I guess, to interface if you wanted to. We're in the Patreon umbrellan. See, I can't talk anymore. Umbrella of Podcastio.
It's that homunculus magic.
It is Podcastio Podcastius, where you can support these, get them on. Well, actually, this one I tend to post straight away, but you get other podcasts to touch early, including Films and Filth, where we talk about really good films and really bad films, alternating those from week to week. Time Enough Podcast, where we talk about the Twilight Zone, and some other folks do some video game ones, like Luke Loves Pokemon, Hyrule Field Report about the Zelda games. And the game show where gamers are gaming each other with gaming questions and other kinds of questions, not always gaming questions. Okay, there's a mystery to solve. Where are my socks?